This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. Anonymous government leaks have played a central role in Trump's first year in office, contributing to an adversarial relationship between the United States and the press. But this is not the first time in recent history that confidential sources have influenced the political narrative. Two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and senior national security correspondent for The Intercept, James Risen, has published a new story that details his experiences working as a national security reporter during the Bush and Obama presidencies. The piece looks at the degree to which the White House attempted and often succeeded in coordinating national security stories with news outlets, as well as the ways in which these two administrations cracked down on leaks. The article, titled "The Biggest Secret: My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror, is published on The Intercept's website. James Risen, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for being here. James, what was your first big story when you began covering the CIA?
Well, I started covering the CIA in 1995 for the Los Angeles Times, and that was at a time when everyone was just starting to leave the CIA because the Cold War was over, and they had just had a big spy case. Aldrich Ames had been revealed to be a Russian spy. And so there was a huge exodus of people from the CIA, and so there were a lot who wanted to talk. And the first story I got really came just from sitting down and listening to people who, you know, the CIA people who were coming out of the agency didn't really know what was news. And this one guy was just droning on about some minor bureaucratic problem, and then he mentioned in passing, oh yeah, this is just like how Bill Clinton covertly allowed the Iranians to ship arms into the Balkans. And then he went back to talking about this minor bureaucratic problem, and I said, wait, go back to that thing you just mentioned about Clinton and Iran. And so that was really the first big story I had, was about how Clinton had agreed to let the Iranians ship arms into the Balkans secretly against U.S. policy in the mid-90s.
Mm-hmm. You know, what was different about the sources you began cultivating? How did you have to change how you worked?
Well, covering the CIA is different from any other beat there is in Washington or anywhere else. Before that, I had covered other beats, like I'd covered the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department, and I covered the auto industry in Detroit. And the CIA is completely different because everything is secret and no one is supposed to meet with reporters. And yet you have a lot of time because they don't have press conferences or press briefings. And so 90% of the job of covering the CIA is figuring out how to meet people. And so that's what I had to learn how to do, was how to meet people, how to go to events where I might meet somebody, how to get somebody to tell me about somebody else who might be willing to talk to me. And it's a very challenging reporting environment that's a real, really interesting as a reporter, because it forces you to try to learn how to do things in a different way than you've ever done before.
James,
and so that was, to me, the most interesting part of it at first.
So, James, was it that the CIA, the folks at the CIA didn't want to talk to you, or was it that you had to learn how to speak their language in order to make them comfortable talking to you?
Oh, it's both. I mean, there were rules against CIA officers talking to the press. And there was also they were very wary of the press, even when they did talk to you. And I found out after a while that the CIA is a lot like high school. You know, it's filled with cliques, and it's filled, you know, the biggest epiphany I think I had covering the CIA came early when I realized the CIA is not filled with James Bonds. It's filled with normal bureaucrats. And they all had their own little, pet peeves and people they liked and people they didn't like and feuds and rivalries, just like everybody else. And so you began to realize you could kind of build networks of sources by, you know, going to one person who would put you in touch with somebody else. And so it was a really interesting experiment for me as a reporter to get into a subculture and really delve into a subculture that I didn't know anything about.
Well, I'm glad you used that word subculture, because you detail a secret subculture that used to exist in Washington before 9/11 that kept, and you write, the national security apparatus running smoothly. Now, describe this information trade and its importance in the national security realm.
Yeah, this was particularly true before all the leak crackdowns. You know, when I first started covering the agency in the mid-90s and up till really in, around the time of 9/11, there was an unspoken understanding that there was a kind of a black market in secrets in Washington. There was reporters, government officials, contractors, military officers, CIA officers, everybody kind of traded information and secrets, and it was really a way to keep the national security system running smoothly. People would leak information partly in order to, you know, get out a policy debate or that had nobody outside the government knew about, and it was also a way, leaks to the press were a way to, you know, bring, in a way, in a indirectly, bring fresh eyes to some stale policy debates, or to kill really terrible ideas. And so it was all, you know, the press was recognized, you know, informally. Nobody would ever say this, but it was recognized by a lot of the smartest people in the national security apparatus that the press had a role to play in helping to shape the way Washington worked.
That's really, that's really interesting. Yeah. Interesting, James. That in your earlier answer, you're talking about how folks in the CIA were forbidden, not allowed to talk to the press, and yet CIA folks leaking to the press were essential to making sure, as you write, that the national security apparatus ran smoothly.
Yeah, there was this weird ambiguity in the whole system that everybody recognized, but nobody wanted to talk about. And that was that there was, leaks were when a major newspaper or broadcast outlet would have a story that included classified information back then, you know, the government would scream and complain, and they would say they were starting a leak investigation, but then they would never do anything about it. And it was all kind of like, you know, Claude Rains in Casablanca, you know, saying, I'm shocked that gambling's going on. And they would, you know, round up the usual suspects, and then nobody would do anything about the leak investigations, and they would just fade away.
Right, and that changed later on, and I want to get to that in a moment. But still, I just want to keep you here for 1 second about the sort of simpatico relationship between the press and the national security apparatus. You describe an informal litmus test for covert operations that one CIA official had during this time as being, quote, how will this look on the front page of the New York Times? How was that mantra of that one CIA official sort of emblematic of that simpatico relationship between the press and the larger national security apparatus?
Yeah, I think it showed that they recognized that the press had a major role on how covert actions and other policies were shaped in Washington. Everyone knew at that time that if you went down some really dangerous path with a policy or a covert action, or you tried to do something that could be considered illegal, that it would probably end up in the press. And that provided a real discipline, I think, to the national security apparatus. It made everyone realize, well, this may be secret now, but it may not be secret forever, and so we better do it the right way. And I think that provided some real discipline to the system that I think we've lost today.
You're listening to James Risen, two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and senior national security correspondent for The Intercept. We're talking about his latest piece, The Biggest Secret, My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror. James, when do you think the relationship started to change between the press and the national security apparatus?
Well, 9/11 played a huge role. I think after 9/11, the Bush administration began to, I think, take advantage of, you know, the increased sentiment in the country about security and the need for greater security to start demanding more regularly than had been done in the past for the press to kill stories about national security matters and counterterrorism matters. You know, the government had always negotiated with the press before that about which stories to run and which ones had not to run. But for the most part, I mean, it was much more selective. And then the Bush administration started cracking down and pressuring the major news organizations not to run things. And then a couple of years later, if you remember, the Valerie Plame case happened when, to make a long story short, there was a CIA officer whose identity was leaked, and people thought it was because the Bush White House was seeking retribution against her husband, who was an Iraq war critic. And so there was a big leak investigation run by a special counsel named Patrick Fitzgerald. And Fitzgerald, since he was a special counsel, he didn't have to abide by the rules that were imposed on the Justice Department and the Attorney General on how to target journalists and how to go after journalists.
James, before you
go, he began subpoenaing reporters all over Washington.
Right, and I want to get into the details of that in a moment, but just to pull back a second, because what's interesting about the work that you do and have done is the fact that there have been stories, particularly since 9/11, where you will read in the story that the paper had been sitting on the story for a year sometimes. Before publishing the paper, before publishing the story, because the administration asked that they not publish it. Can you talk about the tension between the public's right to know and the national security interests of the country?
Yeah, I mean it's a basic tension, and it's something that, as I said, the Bush administration started trying to take advantage of because they recognized, I think, that there was a changed political climate in the country after 9/11, and that the press was part of that. You know, they call it the mainstream media for a reason. You know, the mainstream media reflects the general public's political climate. Although, even though most people wouldn't don't believe that, it's true. The main news organizations in the country tend to follow the political climate of the day. And that was true. A lot of the press was willing to hold or kill or edit, you know, closely edit stories that the government pressured them to do. And it became much more common after 9/11 for the government to go after the press in that way.
I'm wondering, real quickly before we go to a break, and then we can get into the specifics of some of these cases, but can you give a sense to listeners of the internal conversations within a paper like the New York Times when a story is sitting in the basket waiting to go into the paper and a call comes in from the White House saying, please do not run that story? What are the journalistic internal conversations that lead the leadership of a newspaper to hold off on publication?
Well, what usually happens is that there's a series of meetings between the government and the paper. Sometimes, including the meetings, include both the editors and the reporters involved. In some of the cases I was involved with, some of the meetings only included the editors and not the reporters. And so it was a, you know, and it depends on how big of a story it is. Sometimes, you know, the government has kind of a escalating way of telegraphing how serious they think the issue is by how high up, how high ranking officials they put on the phone or have in meetings with the government. You know, in one of the stories I was involved with, it ended with a meeting between President Bush and Arthur Sulzberger, the publisher of the New York Times. So, you know, usually they don't get that high. It's usually just editors meeting with, you know, top officials in the government below the president. So that's it varies, but it can ultimately lead all the way to the top.
You're listening to James Risen. He's The Intercept's senior national security correspondent about his story, The Biggest Secret, My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. We'll be right back after a break. This is Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with James Risen. He has written a new piece for The Intercept called The Biggest Secret, My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror. James is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and a senior national security correspondent for The Intercept. All right, James, let's get into some specifics here. Now, after The Times, The New York Times asked you to match a Washington Post story about Iraq having given nerve gas to terrorists. You refused and put a sign on your desk that said, "You furnish the pictures, I'll furnish the war." What did you mean by that? What message were you trying to send?
Well, it was before the war in Iraq. If you remember, in the year or so before the invasion of Iraq in 2003, the Bush administration was engaged in this relentless campaign to justify the war. Both, they kind of followed two tracks. One was they argued that there was intelligence showing that Iraq and al-Qaeda were allies and were and that Iraq had been working with al-Qaeda. And the other track was that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And both of those assertions ultimately proved to be false. But there were huge pressures on the media at that time for stories that proved either that Saddam Hussein was working with Osama bin Laden or that that Iraq had WMD. And so I had been trying to write some stories before the war saying that that there were intelligence analysts who were skeptical of the intelligence, particularly the stories I was writing were about how they were skeptical of the intelligence on the ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda. And my stories kept getting buried or cut or held, and no one would in the paper, none of the editors would really give me an answer of what was going on. And I was getting very frustrated. And at the same time they were doing that to my stories, they would also come to me and ask me to match stories in other papers that said that there was this connection between Iraq, al-Qaeda, and WMD. And so I was very frustrated and got very angry and refused to go along with what the editors wanted me to do, which was to, you know, match these stories that I thought were just wrong. It was part of this larger climate of the pre-war intelligence, problems in the press.
How difficult, I mean, you're talking about the difficulty in getting your editors to listen to you and to trust your reporting. Was this something that you commiserated with other colleagues at other institutions, that they too were finding that their reporting was being met with skepticism by editors higher up?
At the time, not really. I mean, I didn't really talk to people outside the New York Times about it then. I talked to, you know, other reporters in the paper. I talked to some of them, although there were only a few. I mean, it was a very difficult time period, if you remember.
Right.
Especially the last few months before the war. There was a sense that Bush was going to war, and, you know, we kind of had to get along with it. I mean, it's hard to really diagnose exactly what happened in the press at that moment.
Right.
But the truth is that the press did a very bad job on pre-war intelligence on Iraq.
Right, and asking really tough questions. Here's another story I want to ask you about. You worked on a story about the CIA providing flawed nuclear blueprints to Iran at the start of the invasion of Iraq. Why did this story lead to your meeting with then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice and then CIA Director George Tenet?
Well, it was a story saying, and it was I got this story right as the U.S. was invading Iraq, and right after the invasion, and it showed how badly flawed the CIA's operations were in relationship to weapons of mass destruction. It showed that they had this botched operation on the Iran and its nuclear program. And so I thought, you know, we had just gone to war in Iraq over WMD in part, and there was already talk about a war with Iran. And so I thought this was something really important to write about, to show their mismanagement and the problems they had on WMD intelligence. And when I called the CIA for comment about the story, immediately Condoleezza Rice called Jill Abramson, who was the Washington bureau chief. And Jill and I went to the White House to meet with Rice and Tenet. And they wanted to convince me to kill the story, or convince the New York Times to kill the story. And it was a very intimidating meeting because Rice kind of stared at me and said, I want you to never make another phone call about this. I want you to destroy your notes and forget that you ever knew anything about this story.
That is pretty incredible. When the National Security Advisor to the President of the United States looks you dead in the eye, unsmiling, unflinching, and basically is giving you an order to do what she says.
Right. Yeah, it was pretty intimidating, but at the same time, I also realized she had just confirmed the story, which was it was excellent confirmation of the story.
You
can look at it in two ways.
Well, that is true. And to your point earlier, before we went to the break, you mentioned how you could tell the seriousness of a story by the rank of the person giving you a call back, or the rank of the person calling back to the paper. So you make this phone call, and then the National Security Advisor calls your editor, calls the bureau chief, and then you're summoned to the White House. So you must have known when passing through the White House gates to go to that meeting in the West Wing that you were onto something, and that all you were waiting for was the confirmation that what you were onto was correct.
Yeah. I mean, it was both intimidating and exhilarating at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just Rice. It was Tenet was sitting there, and he also basically confirmed the story, and he only disputed the idea that it was mismanaged.
Right.
And so it was, I remember after the meeting, Jill Abramson and I went to lunch, and we were just kind of stunned about what had happened. And but I also realized, you'll never get better confirmation than that.
Right. So then what did you got confirmation. So what ultimately did the Times decide to do with the story?
Well, they killed it. You know, it happened. It was a very strange time. It happened like right at the same time as the Jason Blair scandal happened.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember that, it was a young reporter who. I mean, I don't remember all the details of what happened.
He made up a lot of things.
Yeah. And he got fired, and then that led to the ouster of the executive editor, Hal Raines. And that was going on right as our meeting, you know, right when this whole thing was happening. And so it was, we were having this, debate and discussion about what to do right as this whole, you know, the whole top leadership of the paper was in crisis mode. And so, you know, finally, Bill Keller was named editor. And he took over, I think, in the early, you know, in June or something like that. And I met with him, and he decided not to run it. I tried a couple times after that over the next year to get him to change his mind, but he wouldn't.
James, was this experience what prompted you to write your book, State of War?
That was part of it. Then after that, I got, you know, another big story that the government also sought to kill. And that on the NSA, which was like the next year.
That was 2004.
Right. And so I was beginning to think about writing a book and including the Iran story in it. And then I got this, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. And then I got this NSA story, and the paper killed that. And
how did you end up having the NSA story corroborated by the head of the NSA at the time?
Yeah, what happened was I had in the spring of 2004, I started meeting with a source who, in the course of a conversation, said to me, you know, I know the biggest secret in the government, but I can't. I'm too scared to tell you what it is. And I realized that this is a good person to meet again and see if I can get them to change their mind about telling me this.
Mm-hmm.
So I met regularly, and finally, I told this source, "You've got to tell me now. What is it that you're talking about?" And then the whole NSA domestic spying program just kind of spilled out. And I was able to confirm it, and then I decided I had to call the NSA, and I just kind of bluffed the NSA public affairs person on the phone. I said, "I've got to talk to Mike Hayden, the director of the NSA, right now." And I didn't tell the PR woman why. And I was shocked that she actually got him on the phone, like, immediately.
Hmm.
And then I wasn't sure what I was going to say to him, and I just said, okay, well, I just read him the first couple paragraphs of the draft of the story, and it was, as I read it, I heard this, like this audible gasp mm-hmm. on the phone. And I realized, yeah, that's kind of like confirmation.
Other than the quick inhale, what did then NSA Director Mike Hayden do after you spoke with him?
Well, you know, first he said, "Oh, whatever we're doing is legal and operationally effective," which was like a backhanded confirmation. And then very quickly he called the Washington bureau chief, who by that time was Phil Taubman. And that began like a year-long series of negotiations between the New York Times and the Bush administration about whether to publish the story.
Mm-hmm. Your story for The Intercept is a long one. "The Biggest Secret: My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror. James Risen, before we go, and the time is dwindling, but we got to talk about a central ruling that impacted much of your experience with the government was Judge Brekema's of the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia, who determined that there was a reporter's privilege under the First Amendment. Describe what this privilege entails.
Yeah, it was when the government subpoenaed me in a leak investigation, she quashed that subpoena, and she argued that there was a reporter's privilege to shield their sources, and which is kind of like a lawyer or a doctor have. And unfortunately, the Obama administration then appealed that decision and had it overturned, so that it was actually the opposite ruling ultimately stood, which is that there is no reporter's privilege, and that that ultimately was how they, unfortunately, the case. You know, that's kind of the legacy on press freedom of the Obama administration.
That sort of changed this dynamic that you talked about at the beginning of this interview, where the national security apparatus running smoothly, that there would be leak investigations, but they would end up going nowhere. That was pre 9/11, and then post 9/11 and into the Obama years, that all changed.
Yeah, it was it became a zero tolerance for leaks in especially in the Obama administration. The Bush administration had started a lot of more aggressive approach to leaks, but the Obama administration became much more aggressive against both the press and their sources and whistleblowers.
Why do you think that was?
I've struggled to understand it. I've never quite understood it. I think the best explanation is that the Obama administration was afraid of right-wing criticism for being soft on leaks. But I've never heard a good explanation for why they did it. And they went after more whistleblowers than all previous administrations combined. And they attacked, they targeted reporters, not just me, other reporters.
Mm-hmm.
And, in my case, this appeals court ruling saying that there is no reporter's privilege still stands in the Fourth Circuit, which is the area that covers Maryland and Virginia, which is home to the Pentagon, the CIA, and the NSA, which are the agencies that will... where most leak investigations happen.
Mm-hmm. James,
so
did you?
It's a very damaging legacy, I think.
Did you end up taking the stand?
There was a pretrial hearing,
right,
but I never had to reveal my sources. So.
And that anticipates the next question I was going to ask you. James Risen, The Intercept's senior national security correspondent. I've been talking to him about his story, The Biggest Secret, My Life as a New York Times Reporter in the Shadow of the War on Terror. James, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks a lot.